Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Catherine Matthews about bladder problems, something I think that's incredibly important to all of our patients.
And unfortunately, we don't talk about it enough, so we're going to have the conversation today. But first, let's talk about some research that matters. This first one is about, it speaks to the obesity epidemic in children.
Well, and it's about drinking sweet drinks in school and access to children to things like soda.
And this was a study, a mailed survey to U.S. elementary school administrators looking at the availability of high-calorie beverages for sale over time, over 3 years, since 2008.
Yep. And a journal called The Archives of Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine, looking at whether students could buy sweetened beverages like sodas, higher-fat milk, and sports beverages from vending machines and school stores.
And we know that these sugar-sweetened sodas are linked to childhood obesity, and you would think that we would be decreasing that availability in schools. But in fact, they found that during the 3 years of the study, 61% of students could buy high-calorie drinks from vending machines or school stores compared with just 49% 2 years prior. So actually, the availability is increasing.
Yeah, this is surprising me. I would have thought that vending machines would have gone down. You know, I've gone into my children's schools and I see vending machines there and you see sodas and things there. And I think, why are these here? And I would think over time, with all the emphasis on people and working on childhood obesity and that these would be removed from the schools. Well, these didn't go down. They didn't go up, but there were more opportunities to buy these beverages at school stores, which is even more shocking.
Well, and the number of school stores has increased, and so it's just more available and a competitive alternative, I guess, to the government lunches or lunches in the cafeteria.
Well, why is that?
I don't know.
Is it because of money?
Well,
I mean, that these kids are, you know, that the schools need the money from the vending machines? I hope that it's not come to that.
Yeah, I don't know why they have them. Like, as an administrator, why would I even want it in my school?
Yeah, it seems like that's an opportunity for stealing and breaking and the money.
Just think you'd have more behavior problems.
Just, you know, let them go to the water fountains.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm old-fashioned, Christy.
I don't know. I'm in agreement
with
you.
What's our very next research that matters?
Okay, this is about strokes. And this is about this thing called the weekend effect, or this question of, do people get, you know, not as good care if they come to a hospital on the weekend, and in this case with strokes?
Yeah, and this was some Canadian researchers who found that people who came into a hospital on the weekend tended to have more severe strokes than the people who came in during the week. And, you know, at first glance, I thought, that's interesting. And maybe even not surprising.
Yeah, well, I think before there was some thinking that it had to do with minor stroke symptoms. People who had more minor stroke kinds of symptoms and they're starting to get better, if it happened on the weekend, they might wait till Monday or Tuesday to be seen by their doctor, and therefore they might have worse outcomes. But in this study, there really wasn't a difference based on how severe your symptoms were, which really points to this weekend effect where maybe we're not giving as good of care on the weekends in hospitals than we once were or than we
had.
Yeah,
you know, because actually I would have thought the opposite, Christy. I would have thought that on the weekend you come on in because you have time and you're not working and so forth. So you come in on the weekend and so, you know, the strokes kind of get, you know, diagnosed quicker even. But it's quite clear that, you know, when you do come into the emergency room in hospitals on weekends, you don't have the same staffing as you do at other times. And I don't know if that has some differences in that the quality of care could be different.
Well, I mean, there have been studies showing that there are differences of this thing called the weekend effect for patients who come for a heart attack or blood clot or strokes, as in this study. So I guess because it's been seen in other places, it's a little more plausible that maybe we're just not giving as good a care on the weekends. But why?
The difference wasn't dramatic here. We should mention that. Then this was in the journal Neurology that 8% of those who arrived on the weekend died within 7 days versus only 7% of those who came in during the week. And so I don't think it's maybe clinically as significant here, but it does raise an interesting question, which I think all of our listeners should be aware of, which is if you come into the hospital on a weekend, you may not get the same care and it may be worse, and you maybe need to be a much stronger advocate and have a patient advocate with your loved one there or for you when you come in on a weekend.
I would agree with that. And in 21,000 people, a difference in 1%, I mean, could be significant. If it's your loved one, it matters. So certainly that advice to advocate is a good one, Adam.
Yeah. Well, I think we want to just talk about advocating. Christy and I, we know it's in the middle of flu season and cold season, and I just recently was called by a patient, Christy, who came down in the flu while traveling down in Alabama, and he wanted to know, it sounded like the flu, and he hadn't gotten his flu shot, and what could I do for him? And we thought we would really maybe come up with some of our top tips for how to really prevent the flu, the cold, what to do if you get it, and stay healthy. How would you respond to that sort of scenario that I just outlined for you, Christy?
Well, in that scenario, I would focus on getting early medical care in terms of, if you've got flu-like symptoms with fever and cough and body aches and that.
He had them all.
He had them all. Then I would advocate to get health care soon, because if you get the medicine, the Tamiflu or the antivirals, in the first 2 days, it can reduce your length of symptoms and, help you get better. Faster.
So you might even call that in that particular
Absolutely.
Case.
Absolutely. We have protocols where we've done that in our practice without having people having to come in. And that really speaks to prevention, in that you don't want to spread those germs to other people.
So would you have chastised him for not getting a flu shot yet?
I wouldn't at the time, but I would have later.
Because he told me he had had a flu shot. And I said, really? When was that? He said, about 4 or 5 months ago. And it turned out he had it last spring for last year's flu.
Oh, yeah, not going to work. Getting the flu vaccine is so important to protect you, to protect your loved ones, your family. Because if you get it, then you're very likely to pass it along. So getting that flu shot every year.
And I think what I've discovered that since the flu epidemic last year and the swine flu, that more people are more concerned about it. And I find I'm having much less conversations this year about the need to do it. There's still people who won't get it done. How do you, if I say I don't want to get it done because I don't think I'm at risk, what would you say back to me?
Well, I ask you, what are your concerns? Like, what is your reservation of getting the flu shot?
Oh, I just think I have a friend who it made them sick.
And I say, that's the thing about the flu shot. And it gets confusing because people come to the doctor where there are germs. It's also during the season where there are lots of flu-like illnesses. And, people think they get the flu shot from the flu, but you actually can't. You can't get the actual flu from the flu shot. But you might pick it up here in the office, so you should wash your hands. And
there's no data that it does make you sick. It might hurt for a little while. I had mine in my left shoulder the other day, and it hurt for a day or so, but it didn't make me sick.
It didn't.
And the flu would have made me really sick.
Absolutely.
It kills people.
And particularly for pregnant women, you absolutely should get your flu shot. But, I don't want to have this conversation without talking about the importance of hand washing.
Yeah. For not only preventing the flu. So what are your top tips just to prevent all sorts of viral upper respiratory infections? You're starting with hand washing.
Absolutely. Hand washing. Do it frequent. Do it again. Do it longer than you wanted to. Keep washing your hands.
And you might need some lotion on your hands to prevent them from getting dried out.
But sure, but I'd rather have dry hands than the flu.
Yeah, don't be sneezing into your hands. My daughter always reminds me of this. Thank you, Eliana. But to cover with my shirt sleeves, I'm not actually sneezing into my hand. A very good way of preventing getting germs on your hands.
Try to avoid touching your face, especially putting your fingers in your mouth, touching your eyes. And if you're around somebody who's got a cold, encourage them to stay home and to not touch surfaces and to shake your hand.
Yeah. Use paper towels and tissues as appropriate and throw them away. Don't leave them outside. And one thing that's not really appreciated is trying to take care of yourself with proper nutrition, proper sleep, and avoiding stress.
And avoiding smoking. Do not smoke, and if you smoke, quit.
Well, that probably concludes our research that matters, and I hope that our discussion of some of our common tips and how we approach this issue is helpful.
That's right. So we do need to take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Catherine Matthews, UNC Division Chief of Urogynecology and Reconstructive Surgery, about bladder problems. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we are going to talk about bladder problems. And this, Adam, is one of those topics that affects so many men and women, yet we don't really talk about it as openly as we probably should. So we're going to talk about it today with an expert.
Yeah, I agree, Christy. We're really fortunate to have with us Dr. Catherine Matthews, who is the Division Chief of Urogynecology and Reconstructive Pelvic Surgery at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Welcome to the show, Dr. Matthews.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I guess one of our really first questions, you know, I think just as Christy mentioned at the introduction, you know, I think of two issues that are really pervasive in so many patients, but unless we bring them up, in the past, patients were kind of reticent to talk about them. And one was impotence or relating men and women with sexual issues, and the other is this issue about bladder problems. Tell us how you became interested in something that really affects so many people.
Well, I think I was really led down this path in residency where one of my favorite surgical mentors was a urogynecologist, and I initially thought that I wanted to be a GYN oncologist, and I noticed that when my mentor was operating on patients and seeing women in the office, he seemed to be restoring confidence and a whole new dimension to quality of life that they valued above many other things. And so I sort of changed my focus from trying to save lives to dramatically improving the quality of life that existed.
That's so interesting that's the big attraction for you, because, I mean, that sounds like a really good fit, because having bladder problems is something that's, you know, it's embarrassing if you urinate on yourself. It's embarrassing if you can't feel like you keep yourself clean, and demeaning or demoralizing to feel like that you have this sort of embarrassing thing that you can't talk about or share. And I can see how it makes people lose confidence in themselves.
You know, I had a lovely example of just this thing a week ago where I had a patient who was referred by an internist who had failed a surgical management for incontinence, and she was accompanied by her sister. And they both were from a farming community. They had very active lives. And her sister complained to me that she had brought up her incontinence to her doctor, and he had said, well, my wife wears pads too. You just need to deal with that. And she said, you know, I was much more worried about this leaking thing than I was my cholesterol, and that's what he was focused on. And so we really didn't have a face-to-face idea as to what was really important in my life. So I really applauded her for being fairly forthright about bringing something to the table that was far more important to her, really, than her cholesterol, something that probably would have, you know, ultimately been more important in terms of her, you know, her morbidity and how long she was going to live, the cholesterol, but that she was really important in the quality of her life.
Let's talk about that for a second. Just this mismatch between sometimes what our patients are interested in and what the doctors feel they need to talk about. This is not an easy subject, I don't think, for doctors, maybe particularly for male doctors. I don't know. Do we find that there's a differential between our male doctors less likely to feel comfortable talking about female issues or bladder issues, even though males get bladder issues, but talking about it with female patients?
You know, I think that it's sort of one of perceived as one of those things that opens up Pandora's box. And I think that in this day and age where people's office visits are very limited, they're confined to 10 and 15 minute windows, that managing things that are thought to affect you know, life-threatening problems usually take precedence. And so, you know, I'm not really sure it's so much of a gender issue as it is a time issue and a comfort level with the subject. So, you know, I think that telling someone that they can just continue to cope with something is almost easier than just making a referral to someone who dedicates their whole life to the management of the problem.
Yeah, but that's not a very compassionate sort of statement. You're just going to have to deal with this.
It's really not, but it's unbelievable how often, you know, people sort of view this as something that can be coped with. And, and truth be told, a lot of women, because they get so used to dealing with, you know, dealing with menstruation, they sort of are used to dealing with fluid leakage of something. But it's quite phenomenal to me how women become copers and how they manage to just sort of deal and live with this problem and start, instead of wearing pads for 3 or 4 days a month, you know, resort to wearing them every day. And so they, in some measure, sort of participate in the ongoing problem, and that they sort of are great copers and they don't realize that life can actually be very different. And there's one thing I can say about my patients who actually end up getting treatment. They're like, why did I not do this 10 years ago? I can't believe I've lived with this problem for so long.
Wow. Well, let's talk about understanding the issues. I know a while back we learned more about different types of urinary incontinence. We certainly see it a lot in women after childbirth or women as they age. But does it matter to try to distinguish between these different types of incontinence?
Or even let's even back, what's that word incontinence really mean?
Because
we use that word. Yeah.
Not being able to make it.
When we talk
bathroom.
About bladder problems, are those synonymous? Are those the same as incontinence? And what does that mean?
So incontinence is just the uncontrolled leakage of urine or of bowel, you know, whatever the fluid is. And it is very important to distinguish the type because they are treated very differently. So in women, and this is slightly different than in women, the most common overall type of incontinence is stress incontinence, which is a spurt or a leakage whenever you increase the pressure in your belly, be it through coughing, sneezing, laughing, lifting, running, jumping with your children on a trampoline.
Not emotional stress.
Not emotional
so
stress.
So that's I cough or sneeze and let some fluid out.
That's correct.
Okay.
As opposed to the gotta go problem where people know where every toilet is in Chapel Hill, they have the urgency, the frequency, getting up at night. And these are the patients who are having problems with an overactive bladder muscle. And this problem is never able to be effectively treated surgically. It's a problem with a bladder muscle that has basically escaped the brain's control. We don't know why it develops exactly, what the pathogenesis of the problem is, but that is a medical problem that needs treatment with bladder retraining and medicines as opposed to any kind of surgical or device intervention.
You mentioned in men it's a little bit different. How does it differ in men?
So the most common type of leakage in men is overflow incontinence because of prostate problems. And so for them, because they are unable to empty completely, they can develop almost like a dam that's overflowing, leakage from that. So men, it's fairly rare for them to have stress incontinence. They can develop overactive bladder, but it's far less common in men than in women.
So, Dr. Matthews, you mentioned something about stress incontinence being the most common thing for women, and that there are many more treatments perhaps designed for that. Talk to us a little bit about what to do about stress incontinence. And we may just be able to start on this because we're going to have to take a break pretty soon.
The least invasive treatment for stress incontinence, and this works for mild cases, is to do pelvic floor physical therapy or the elusive Kegel exercise where you contract the pelvic floor muscles. Strengthening those, just like any other gym routine, results in increased tone of the muscles, and this helps to prevent leakage when there is a sudden increase in pressure in the abdomen.
And how do you spell that, just for our listeners?
For Kegel exercises, K-E-G-E-L.
And how do you teach people to do that? How do you describe that that muscle that needs to be contracted?
The best way, sort of a poor man's way to teach a Kegel, is to have women try And when they initiate a urinary stream, try and cut off the stream midstream, because in order to cut off the stream, they're going to have to pull up on the right muscles. And some women can't learn how to do this just on their own. They require some biofeedback, some training with some manual manipulation to sort of learn which muscles to use. But generally speaking, if you're able to cut off the urinary stream, you can identify which muscles you need to be using.
Great. Well, I know we're just touching on some of the treatment options, but we do need to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Catherine Matthews, about bladder problems. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You've been listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. Catherine Matthews of the UNC Division of Urogynecology and Reconstructive Pelvic Surgery. And Dr. Matthews, right before we broke, we were talking about stress incontinence. And I realized that, you know, what causes stress incontinence in women? What's the role of childbearing in this sort of element? And, you know, is this why women get it more often than men? And can we prevent this problem from ever occurring?
So it depends on what age of the patient is that you're looking at. Certainly in younger women, the biggest risk factor is having been pregnant, which is a hard thing to prevent if you're interested in having children.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not wanting to prevent that.
So it's not even actually, we know that a lot of women have questions about mode of delivery and how that impacts things. Really the biggest risk factor is being pregnant in the first place. In terms of actual mode of delivery, having had a vacuum or a forceps delivery, an operative vaginal delivery, has been found to have a significant risk compared to women who have a natural vaginal birth or a cesarean section.
And is that, that's independent of if a woman had a tear during delivery?
That's correct. It's very rare that a woman has a forceps or a vacuum delivery and doesn't sustain some degree of tear.
Sure.
So really, you know, if you ask what is the biggest pregnancy and delivery risk factor, it's having a forceps or a vacuum delivery. In older patients, it's very interesting that if you actually query women who are postmenopausal in their 50s and 60s, you find that age becomes a big equalizer of the problem, in that most women who are over the age of 60, regardless of whether or not they had children, they can have similar rates of stress incontinence. And this is probably because weight and the aging of the pelvic tissues becomes much more significant. And really, probably obesity in that cohort is the biggest risk factor. The more weight you have in your abdomen, the more weight there is pressing on the bladder, and the more difficult it is for the urethra, the tube that you urinate out of, to actually have more resistance.
So you can do something about your weight over time, potentially. Unless something that you could potentially change if you worked hard enough.
Absolutely. And we've actually got good studies showing that even if you lose 5% of your body mass, you can significantly improve stress incontinence.
Oh, really? But I'm thinking about people who have a vacuum or a forceps delivery, or as you get older, those are things you can't necessarily change. But are there things that you can do as you get older, or if you've had that kind of delivery and you know you're at higher risk, are there things that you can do to prevent it?
Like doing the Kegel exercises.
Yeah, so the main thing one can do is to do active pelvic floor physical therapy, really keep doing the Kegels. And they've shown in several good studies in Sweden and Norway that if you actively and continue to do the Kegel exercises, you can prevent the problem from developing. As soon as you stop doing the exercises, then classically, just like if you stop doing any other exercise, you very quickly gain weight and get out of shape, and the same is true of the pelvic floor.
What's active and consistent? Because that might mean different things to different people. Do you need to do it 20 minutes a day, 7 days a week? Or
I tell people to do it at the stoplight or during
what do you recommend?
Or how do you tell people?
That's, you know, it's just like anything else. A little bit is good and a lot is even better. So the more people can do it anytime they're thinking about it, sitting, working on a computer or anything, you know, doing five contractions symptoms in an hour is good.
Good. Well, what about other treatments? You know, clearly there's role for medications, and tell us how and when medications become involved. And then also let's talk about what you probably spent a lot of your life doing, which is surgery. When do folks need to consider surgery for problems with leakage?
So for stress incontinence, there's no medicine that works. The other option besides physical therapy is a device called a pessary, which looks like a diaphragm that goes in the vaginal canal, and it provides some support to the urethra, and women can insert and remove this on their own. And this may be particularly helpful if someone, for example, is only leaking when they go to their aerobics class 3 times a week. They may like to use a pessary during their class. And then the third most invasive option for stress incontinence is the placement of a synthetic sling that provides a stable platform of support under which the urethra can be compressed when a woman coughs or sneezes. And one of the things that I was very happy to bring to UNC when I joined the faculty in July was being able to do this procedure under local anesthesia with just IV sedation, so we can have the patients actively cough for us in the operating room, so we can adjust the sling to the exact tension that we need. We're not guessing. We're really sort of fine-tuning so that it's just tight enough to prevent the bad urine from coming out, but loose enough to allow the good urine to come out.
That's kind of like being able to sit on the sofa before you purchase it. I mean, you get to see the impact before you finish.
That's exactly correct.
Well, so it's not like, oh, well, this might work, but you'll know that it works because you've tested it right there.
That's exactly right. And you can see that the delicate balance you walk down, and that you know, I can make anyone dry. The question is, can I put a sling in that's going to allow someone to be able to empty normally?
They'll never urinate again.
That's dangerous.
And be able to not leak.
Wow.
So the medications that you mentioned that you see advertised on television, for example, are all for management of the gotta go problem.
The overactive bladder.
Correct. And so, you know, so we see a lot of people who come in who've been put on these medications who don't have overactive bladder, and they're never going to work for people who just have stress incontinence.
So you can do studies that determine the difference between the two, clearly. What about things like caffeine, alcohol? People are drinking lots more water because they've been told to drink all the time. What's the role of those sorts of things in causing incontinence?
That's a great question. Obviously, what goes in has to come out. And people drink in general in vast excess of what's recommended. The national recommended daily intake of fluids in a 24-hour period is only 48 ounces, 6 8-ounce glasses. And that includes all the liquid really in the form of solid food, so soups and all, you know, salads that are mostly water. So generally speaking, people drink far too much. And then caffeine compounds the problem, because not only does caffeine act as a diuretic, making people void more than they actually took in, but it also actually causes direct spasm of the bladder, because the caffeine makes you release calcium, and this causes the cells to undergo spasm. So people who are drinking a lot of caffeine, if we merely change their dietary intake, this can have a profound and dramatic impact on bladder function.
And what about people who maybe due to their job are working long hours and not stopping to go to the restroom or holding it for a really long time? You always hear that that's going to stretch your bladder and cause you to have problems.
You know, that's one of the oldest wives' tales that needs to be disbanded. The bigger problem is people who get into a habit of going frequently in response to a bladder urge. And this then starts to set up the cycle where the bladder is dictating what's going on as opposed to your brain. And then the bladder capacity, how much it likes to hold, generally gets less and less. And this can then create a cycle of a problem of this constant urge to go. So we really, one of our techniques to overcome overactive bladder is actually to get people to void on a set schedule and gradually increase the time in between voids to really work on holding it more.
So instead of mind over matter, it's mind over bladder.
That's correct.
Adam.
Very good.
Nice, Adam.
Well, you know, this is, you know, you started with quality of life, and I am certain that the work you're doing is increasing the quality of life. I congratulate you on going into a field where you are really making a huge difference for women and men.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Dr. Catherine Matthews, chief of the UNC Division of Urogynecology and Reconstructive Pelvic Surgery, about bladder problems. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For House Calls segment of our show today, let's talk about your health questions and concerns.
And if you have a question you'd like for us to address, we want you to send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And now we'll have our producer read some of the questions we have today.
I'm a single mother, and I recently asked my doctor if I could email her with health questions. It takes a lot for me to get time off work to take my daughter to the doctor, and I want to be able to access my doctor without coming in for an appointment. I really don't like it if I go to the trouble to bring her in and she doesn't even get an antibiotic, so I'd like to know before bringing her. My doctor pretty much said no to personal emails, but told me how to access the advice nurse and how to email through a secure system. What do you think about that?
Well, that's a great question, and it's unclear a little bit about thinking about what. There's lots of things to think about this case, so maybe we can just take turns and give some of our thoughts, because this raises lots of interesting and important questions, so thank you for at least asking them.
It does. The first one that comes to mind is that just how hard I can imagine it would be to be a single mom, to be having to take off work to take your child in, and then that feeling that you say of if you don't get an antibiotic, you kind of feel like it was a wasted visit. And I would really encourage you to try to reframe that a little bit and think about the value of that you're getting from the doctor at that visit to determine whether or not your child needs it. Because if she doesn't need it, you don't want her to have a medicine that could have side effects or other bad outcomes.
And also, I think you need to respect the fact that not all of these things can be easily diagnosed without seeing someone and examining them and the personal interaction. So perhaps it's not totally realistic or fair in some circumstances to really expect that advice is giving out over the internet. And also, I mean, doctors are professionals and they make their living by giving out professional advice and getting paid for that. And email is not something that traditionally patients pay for or that doctors charge for. So you
Although you have to respect it. There are doctors who charge for emails and phone calls. That can be done. Mm-hmm. But most offices have some sort of system, and it sounds like your doctor does too, to get through to an advice nurse during the day or at night to help you determine some simple tips of when you need to bring your child in or not to have that conversation. So an email, there are privacy issues, there are rules that the doctors have to follow about email that might also be a factor there.
And we know that it's not easy to get off work, but a lot of doctors are having later hours to make it more convenient over lunchtime, early in the morning, so that really a lot of doctors' practices are really trying to work to become really patient-centered. And communication on the phone and email is one of them, but hopefully you can find different ways of getting your answers, but also maybe having more flexibility to have the relationship with your doctor meet your needs.
Absolutely. Julie, what do we have next?
My 10-year-old son recently had bad stomach pains. I'm not one to rush to the emergency room for everything, but it was a weekend and he couldn't even walk. He was doubled over in pain. I looked on WebMD and I was worried about appendicitis. It turns out he was just really constipated, and the doctors gave him an enema, which made him better. Now I feel like I shouldn't have taken him to the emergency room. How am I supposed to know when to take him?
Well, it sounds like you took him when you needed to. That if he was doubled over that much in pain and you're worried about appendicitis and it's the weekend, then, you know, it's not wrong to have done what you did, and they gave a treatment that made a difference. So I think that's an appropriate use if you didn't have another way to help them feel better.
Yeah,
Adam,
you know,
this is
physicians have the same problem. We have our children. You know, it reminds me of, you know, I've been in the emergency room with my children when they've had lots of pain, and I think one of them may have had constipation at one point in time. And constipation can mimic really bad appendicitis, and you don't want to miss appendicitis, so don't feel bad. I mean, I think we all look backwards and we found out the things that we you know, knew in retrospect, we'd be rich, you know, looking at stock market picks, for instance. So, you know, you did the right thing there.
Well, you wouldn't want to look back and say, oh, I wish I had taken him and he had a burst appendix.
Yeah, and the pain was real here. I mean, constipation is not a good thing for anyone.
Well, I'm glad he got some treatment and glad it didn't turn out to be something.
I think you need to take him when your instinct says, trust your instincts here, says to take him. And we deal with the same thing. So thanks for sharing. Mm-hmm. What do we have next, Julie?
I recently went to the hospital for a mini stroke. After the symptoms went away, I felt totally fine. The doctors and nurses at the hospital were very nice, and they ran a whole bunch of tests. On the morning I was supposed to go home, they reviewed everything with me, and I was ready to go. But I had to wait all day for the physical therapist to come before I could leave. And it turns out that the therapist never came, so I went home anyway. I didn't even want to see the therapist in the first place, since I was walking just fine. Why does being in the hospital sometimes feel like you have no control?
Probably because lots of times you don't seem to have a lot of control.
Yeah.
It's really unfortunate. I hear this at times, and recently had Christy, I think we need to write a blog about this, about you know, the lack of control that people have, not even about choosing their food sometimes and choosing when to go to the bathroom. And I mean, it's just all kinds of things.
Yeah, well, and it's such a vulnerable time when you're scared. And I mean, something as serious as a mini stroke, that's a really vulnerable time. Even though you felt better, that's scary. And then to not have any control and to finally be like, okay, I'm getting out of here, like it's prison or something, and they keep you there all day, I could see how that would be really frustrating.
And, you know, even though not having seen the therapist, sometimes the problems you have are subtle, and you may not necessarily be fully aware of all of the, if you have had even a small stroke, that you might have some balance problems.
Mm-hmm.
And talking with a therapist is probably a good idea, but it's not okay that they didn't come to see you and they kept you waiting there. And I would encourage you to write a letter to your doctor, to the administrator, to the head of the physical therapy department, indicating the problems you had, and hopefully see if they'll write back to you and apologize for those problems.
Good advice. Julie, what do we have next?
I need to know how to lose weight. I've tried so many things, and with the holidays coming, I feel like I'm only going to gain more weight. What can I do?
Oh, that's a great question, and it's a very timely one because during the holidays, a lot of people do gain weight and feel sort of like they have to wait until the new year to do it. And I think it's good for you to empower yourself to try to prevent it. So I have some tips. Adam,
this is a bad timing. It's the best of worlds and worst worlds because we're right here in front of Thanksgiving and Christmas and lots of Christmas and holiday parties here. But the very simple fact is the way you lose weight is to have less food in, then less energy out. Less energy in, then less energy out. And that sounds so simple and so, you know, maybe overly simplistic, but that's the truth.
So I tell people to try to increase your exercise over the holidays, try to plan some healthy meals, to try to eat a healthy snack before the party so that you can just taste some things and still enjoy it but not go show up around all this crazy food when you're super, super hungry.
Yeah, you need like a break between the food that looks good and the decision to pick up that food and eat it. There needs to be – so, you know, take a deep breath frequently and decide, do I want to eat this or not? I mean, I think frequently I go to parties and I see this food out there and I'm not really hungry.
Right.
But I see it and I'm trained
to
eat it.
People are talking about how good it is.
And sometimes I'll just take a deep breath and I'll say, I really don't want that. I'm not even sure it would taste good either.
And it's not really worth it to me.
Yeah. And so, but how you slow that train down, because it's leaving the station, it's going very, very fast, and all of a sudden you got to put a brake on.
It is. But I think it's wonderfully wise that you're thinking about this during the season and that you're really trying to take some steps to prevent the weight gain that a lot of people experience.
There are some new novel companies, they're for-profit companies that are starting to do some things that are, you know, I don't know if they work well, but they're probably not that expensive. But they will, there's one I think called Health E, and that's based here in North Carolina, Christy, and you talk with them and pay a certain amount a month, and they'll send you text messages and they'll send you emails and they'll communicate with you, and you have a relationship about what you're taking and eating on a daily basis and their recommendations of how to deal with it. So I do think this common denominator of continuously getting feedback, and
right.
we probably don't have the time to give that kind of feedback to
no,
people on a regular basis.
No, but there are lots of programs. I use Weight Watchers. I think I've told you this before, that I still use it, log it, and especially during the holidays, because that way you can account to have some sort of balance in your eating when you're actually logging what you do.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that's some ways that we can help you maintain and really lose some weight. We've also talked about ways of understanding wait times, again, in the hospital when it's ready to discharge and what's not okay when people don't show up.
About when to go to the emergency room when you're worried about a child or yourself.
And how you can really expect to correspond with a physician about through email about serious health problems.
So hopefully that's these have been some helpful tips for you, and we've addressed some issues that are important to you and your health. And we want you to write us by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can call us at 919-966-8081. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter.
Thank you to UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, our great guest today, Dr. Catherine Matthews, and we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
And on behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll see you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.